Thank you, ma'am.
Good morning. My name is Carol Ventura, Executive Director of Rhode Island Housing. This is the November 10th, 2020 meeting of the Rhode Island Housing Board of Commissioners Credit Committee. CJ Rotella, the Director of Information Technology for Rhode Island Housing, will provide information on this telephonic meeting.
Good morning, this is CJ Rotella. This meeting will be recorded and available for review on Rhode Island Housing's website within 3 to 5 business days after this meeting. Except for the Credit Committee, Board of Commissioners, and specific Rhode Island Housing staff, all callers will be muted during this meeting. To prevent feedback or background noise, we ask the commissioners and participating staffs to please mute your phone if you are not speaking. During this meeting, if anyone is having technical difficulties with audio or accessing the call, they should call 401-457-1240. Thank you.
This is Carol Ventura. Nicole Clement, General Counsel for Rhode Island Housing, will provide information on this telephonic meeting.
Thank you, Carol. Good morning, everyone. This is Nicole Clement. Pursuant to Executive Order 20-46, extended by Executive Order 20-93, and as may be further amended or extended, this meeting is being held via teleconference. Members of the public can visit the Rhode Island Housing website to view the agenda and information on the actions being taken. In the event this teleconference is interrupted, we will stop the meeting until we can reconnect and audio is restored. I will now like to provide some additional information for our commissioners in attendance. Please note that Committee Chairman Orth will preside over this meeting. I also ask that any commissioner or staff member speaking during this meeting state their name prior to speaking, and that you mute your line when you are not speaking. I would now like to invite Committee Chairman Orth to call the meeting to order. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Nicole. I'd now like to call the meeting to order. We have a rather short agenda, but we do have some important discussion items, so I really appreciate your attention today. I'd now like to ask Carol to conduct a roll call attendance, please.
Thank you, Commissioner Orth. I will now conduct a roll call of members of the Credit Committee, Board of Commissioners in attendance, and staff of Rhode Island Housing. Chairman Nicholas Ritsinas.
Here.
Commissioner Kevin Orth.
Here.
Commissioner Elizabeth Tanner.
Here.
Commissioner Maria Barry.
Here.
Staff of Rhode Island Housing. James Comer.
Here.
Lisa Primiano.
Here.
Carol LaChapelle.
Here.
Eric Shorter.
Here.
Christine Hunsinger.
Here.
Ann Berman.
Here.
Michael DiCaro.
Here.
Nicole Clement.
Here.
CJ Rotella.
Here.
Nancy Bacon.
Here.
Commissioner Orth, the roll call is complete.
Great. Thank you, Carol. I would now like to introduce committee action item number 1, which is the approval of minutes of the Credit Committee meeting held on October 9th, 2020. Is there a motion to approve?
So moved.
I heard at least a 1 and a 2 on there. I'll take that. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, Nicole, would you please conduct a roll call vote?
Thank you, Commissioner. This is Nicole Clement. When I call your name, if you are in favor of approving the minutes of the Credit Committee meeting held on October 9th, 2020, please respond by saying aye or opposed by saying nay. Commissioner Orth.
Aye.
Chairman Ritsinas.
Aye.
Commissioner Tanner.
Aye.
Commissioner Barry.
Aye.
The vote is unanimous. The motion passes. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Nicole. I'd now like to introduce committee action item number 2, which is the recommendation for transfer of physical assets for Riverstone Apartments. And I'd like to invite Ann Berman, the Assistant Director of Development, to present this item.
Good morning. Thank you, Kevin. This action is for approval of the purchase and transfer of the general partner interest in Riverstone Apartments Limited Partnership. The development consists of 103 units. It serves seniors age 62 or over, and disabled individuals. There are 7 buildings. By way of history, this project was originally developed as 2 separate HUD 202s by the ARC of Blackstone Valley. In 2011, the ARC refinanced the 2 developments into 1 single asset entity known as Riverstone, using tax-exempt bonds and 4% credits. And all of the units underwent a fairly comprehensive rehab at that time. All but one of the units is subject to 2 HAP contracts. Michael Associates was the investor of the original 2011 transaction. The development is still in its compliance period, which runs until 2028. Standard Property Company has entered into a purchase and sale agreement with Blackstone Valley ARC to purchase 99% of the general partner's interest. At closing, the general partnership interest purchased by Standard or by the Standard-related entity will be converted to a 0.0099% limited partnership interest in the owner. And Blackstone Valley ARC will remain with a very, very small ownership interest as the general partner. And this is a little bit different than what we've seen in other developments. Because these were 202s, Blackstone Valley ARC, there needs to be a nonprofit-related, nonprofit-related entity associated with the transaction, which is why Blackstone Valley ARC is retaining just a small sliver of the general partnership interest. Michael Associates has approved the proposed sale, and they will remain as the limited partner. And Standard will assume all of the existing obligations under the existing loan agreements, notes, mortgages, regulatory agreements, etc. The development's doing quite well. It scored a 84 out of 100 on our most recent risk rating, with a debt service coverage last year of 1.24. And the reserves are quite well funded. As part of the transfer, the existing property manager, which is Phoenix Property Management, will be replaced by the Franklin Johnston Group, which is a privately held real estate development and management company based in Virginia. The Franklin Johnston Group manages almost 19,000 units in over 100 developments, mid-Atlantic, southeast, really from Rhode Island all the way down to Florida. Franklin Johnston Group, they also manage other properties for Standard in Rhode Island, Charles Place, Colony, and Curtis Arms. Franklin Johnston will provide the services associated with the development. Blackstone Valley ARC will also continue to be engaged in that regard as well. There's no identity of interest between Standard and the Franklin Johnston Group, and HUD approvals are underway. We don't expect any issues. I don't know if anybody has any questions.
Great. Thank you very much, Ann. I'd like to request a motion to recommend approval of committee action number 2 to the Board of Commissioners.
So moved, Maria Berry.
Second, Liz Tanner.
Great. Thank you both. Any questions about this action?
Kevin, I have one. It may not apply to this project, ironically, but it gives me a chance to talk about it. I noticed that the transfer, a number of compliance and ADA issues would be funded out of the reserves and the like, which is all sound and the like. I wonder to what extent we ought to be looking at the pandemic in terms of the complications that are involved there, and whether there are anything that should be funded out of reserves to cover some of those areas, like ventilation and some others. Again, it may not apply to this particular project. I don't want to go back in time, but just a larger question.
I think that's a great question. Do we have Mike on the line?
Yes, I'm here.
Is that something that you could address, Mike?
Yes, so I think... and it's hard to think about just this particular property, but we're certainly open to utilization of reserves for items like ventilation, any capital improvement or support that we could offer to the sites. There's no prohibition against it, and certainly if the reserves are funded adequately, we would allow it.
What might be some of the areas? I mentioned ventilation and the like. What else would be covered, do you think? Or could be covered?
Yes, yeah, so even if it's not capital related, we could make exceptions and allow, you know, if they have to purchase additional cleaning supplies, even staffing, if they need to bring in, you know, some kind of specialized cleaning company or other services, we could allow that to be funded from reserves.
Any other comments or questions about this item?
Liz, I have one other follow-up, if I could, Kevin. Liz,
sure.
You've been very much involved in the dilemma with the virus and some of the issues there. Is there an opportunity here to kill two birds with one stone?
So the DBR COVID task force is always available for walkthroughs, for inspections, for phone calls. You know, whatever is appropriate under the circumstance, we can do whatever you think is needed to make those hard calls or do those inspections if needed.
Okay. Well, it's something I think we should think about. Again, I don't want to act precipitously as relates to this particular project or make this a guinea pig, but it's just something we should be aware of and look forward to addressing.
I agree, Nick. I think it's also obviously a little difficult to get inside occupied units to do
yep.
particular types of work right now. So we need to be, you know, conscious of that as
Absolutely.
Well. Maria or Liz, any comments or questions on this item?
No comments for me.
No? Okay. Great. Nicole, would you please conduct a roll call vote on this one?
Thank you, Commissioner. This is Nicole Clement. When I call your name, if you are in favor of recommending approval of the transfer of physical assets for Riverstone Apartments to the Rhode Island Housing Board of Commissioners, please respond by saying aye or opposed by saying nay. Commissioner Orth.
Aye.
Chairman Rezinas.
Aye.
Commissioner Tanner.
Aye.
Commissioner Barry.
Aye.
The vote is unanimous. The motion passes. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Nicole. We'll now move into our discussion items. And the first one is the fiscal year 2021 operating budget. The management committee has oversight of this and will be, I believe, voting on it. But Carol and staff have graciously offered to have a run through with our committee so that we can ask some more detailed questions that we might not have the time or to do in a full board meeting. So with that, Carol, if you could please present this discussion item.
Certainly. Thank you. This is Carol Ventura. Today, Carol LaChapelle and I will walk you through our proposed fiscal year 21 budget. We're going to go through a number of documents that were uploaded in one packet to board docs, and it includes a budget summary memo, a summary of our overall projected housing investments for fiscal year 21, our proposed 21 program budget, a multi-year summary and comparison of revenues and expenses to the agency, a few charts prepared by the finance group in our proposed 21 operating budget. So please jump in as Kara and I walk through this with you. With any questions, stop us if you need more detail. So turning our attention to the budget memo, as indicated in the summary, the projected bottom line net revenue for fiscal year 21 is $7.9 million. The budget reflects our move to bond our single family loans versus sale of our loans in the TBA market. While this provides a great opportunity to go back to growing our portfolio, it does reduce immediate revenue for the agency. We also anticipate a reduction in demand for our single-family loan products due to rising housing values and persistent unemployment. I'm hoping that our new down payment program will help to mitigate the reduction in single-family production, but we're already seeing this year our initial goal that we had projected, we're not going to meet that. So I fully expect to see lower production going into next year. We are also projecting a reduction in our fee collection due to federal regulations that prohibit us from collecting fees on delinquent single-family loans. I expect that we will continue to have a large number of staff working remotely next year. On a given day, we have anywhere between 150 and 180 staff working from home. As you might imagine, this puts incredible pressure on our IT group to ensure that folks have the tools that they need and access to programs to ensure they can do that work. The combination of remote work, ongoing support, and necessary upgrades for our existing programs and new initiatives has resulted in an overall increase in our technology budget. We are projecting a slight increase in personnel salary expenses, primarily to provide the flexibility we need to ensure that we are able to recruit for some vacant positions. We have been challenged to recruit for IT and finance positions, so this will help us give us a little bit of flexibility to negotiate on salary. There is no agency-wide merit increase for staff proposed in this budget. There will be an increase to our healthcare expenses of approximately 9%. I want to note that the projected 21 net revenue does not include the $1.1 million transferred to the state that's currently in the budget. This number is subject to change based on actions the state may take with respect to their budget. So let me pause there on the memo for any questions you have. All right.
Carol, this is Kevin. You had mentioned staff size reduction. So could you just give us an overview of kind of where we are now, where you foresee us going in that regard?
Yeah. We've been seeing incremental reductions in staff. We were at a high. Actually, Lisa probably has better statistics than me. Let me pull this up. Yeah, Lisa put together some statistics on where we've gone. We were at a high in 2019 of 247 employees. Currently, right now, we're at 225. Much of the downsizing is directly related to, loss of programs. For example, Building Homes Rhode Island, you know that we administer these funds on behalf of the Housing Resources Commission, that all of those funds have pretty much been allocated. So we've downsized on the program area. Also in homeownership, we've been deploying HHF funds, but at the height of that, we were heavily staffed in the HHF program. In fact, we had an off-site remote location on Jefferson Boulevard to be able to manage that program. So I think we may see a little bit more of a reduction in staff, probably, again, related to the program side, but it's going to be mitigated by the need in, like, Leslie's area, right, post all of these forbearance. Leslie's going to have to beef up on her customer service side. So it's very hard to predict. A lot of it depends on what the federal government does with stimulus money and whether or not we're going to inherit programs from the state or create our own programs as a result of that, which will necessitate an increase. I know there will be certain areas, though, like Leslie's group, where we're going to have to increase. Right now, Leslie is really struggling. We've tried to bring temps in, and it's been incredibly difficult to engage temps and keep them. That's kind of my forecast, Kevin. And it's hard to predict until we know what kind of stimulus programs are going to come out of the new administration.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Okay. So let's move on to page 1 through 3 in the packet. And this is a summary of housing investments that we expect to make during the fiscal year. We presented this in some detail to Kevin and Chairman Redsinas earlier this year. It gives you an overview in one document of everything that you approve, all of the investments you approve throughout the year that we use in Rhode Island to really move our economy. So this year we're projecting to deploy more than $700 million into the Rhode Island economy as a result of these investments. And we've broken it down into six categories, which I think helps to frame where the investments go. And there is a lot of information in this summary, so rather than go through it in detail, why don't I pause, and if you have questions in different areas of this, let me address them. One other thing I'll mention is this summary, pages 1 through 3, isn't part of this action item because most of the programs in here, as commissioners, you approve them throughout the year. So, for example, home funds are included in here. You don't approve that as part of the annual budget, but you approve facilities throughout the year in terms of funding of the program. Okay. Not hearing
I'll chime in.
Okay.
First of all, thank you for presenting this in such a format. I think it's helpful to see where our money goes and how it's used to assist in the various ways of buying or keeping homes. Under the programs to create affordable homes and the use of our housing trust fund monies and also some other self-generated funds, you note $4 million for pre-development and land bank programs. I understand the flexibility you'd like there and also to help our, I guess, primarily nonprofit partners put together, you know, viable transactions. I think it's worthwhile. The amount of that $4 million seems a bit high to me, and I'd just comment that I would rather see less in kind of speculative future development and maybe more in, you know, ready-to-go type developments.
It's interesting. We have seen more interest in our land bank program. It's probably worth bringing an update to credit committee next month so we can give you some insight. In addition to our land bank program, I think you all know that some of the CARES Act funds is being used by our agency to acquire properties. James Comer has been spearheading that initiative with some of the state folks. And while we were a little uncertain as to whether that program was going to take off, I'm happy to report that Rockville Mill is closing if it hasn't already closed. And, you know, because of Christine's work and James' work, we will be acquiring property for Crossroads that they will be able to use temporarily as a shelter in South Providence, but then convert to permanent supportive housing with actual health care services on site in the future. So there, I'm seeing a bit more demand for the land bank program or for acquisition financing in general. But thank you for your comments on that, and we get it. So let's come back to you with a report on the good work we're doing next month.
Okay, that sounds great. Thank you.
Okay, hearing no other comments, let me move on to pages 4 and 5 of this packet, which is part of this action item, and it's titled Rhode Island Housing Program Budget Fiscal Year 21. And along with this summary is a description of the programs that are included and that we will fund with our operating dollars. The first subcategory budget area is our support for homeless programs. This really relates to rental programs that and rental funds we deploy in the community, state rental assistance, and the neighborhood opportunities programs were state programs that came over to Rhode Island Housing to fund after they were created. Also in this category, our HomeSafe program, you know, we created this back in the spring to assist individuals that were experiencing a housing crisis. We're continuing to deploy these resources alongside the CARES Act funding that's being used by a number of other agencies throughout the state to help renters pay arrearages and also help homeowners that are delinquent in their mortgage. One thing I'd like to highlight here is we are going, in addition to our operating funds, we're going to use a grant, a $500,000 grant that we received from Federal Home Loan Bank to further support this program, and I think there's going to be increasing demand once we get beyond the first of the year. The next subcategory relates to our investments in community development activities, and LISC is the sole entity we're proposing to fund. We have been funding LISC for probably decades now. They utilize our resources to leverage another $4 for our $1 to help our CDCs. moving on to our community support programs, we are proposing to fund two programs in this area that support homeowners, potential homeowners, as well as residents living in our developments. We'll do a competitive round of funding for these two programs, and we're requesting an increase of $50,000 over last year. We will be introducing a new program in our loan center this year that we're excited about. I think I just saw some branding come over from Christine. It's going to help strengthen the pool of home buyers in Rhode Island by providing critical financial literacy and home buyer education to them. In exchange for their participation in these programs, we are going to create an escrow fund, a three-month PD escrow fund for these home buyers. And they can use that escrow in case they get into trouble. If something comes up, an emergency comes up, we can use the escrow fund to pay their mortgage for them so they don't become delinquent. So we're going to work with a number of community partners, including CAP agencies, to deploy these resources. So I'm excited about this program. I think it's going to strengthen our single-family portfolio and provide opportunities for a more diverse pool of home buyers. Lastly, we are proposing to support the ZEOS program. It's been incredibly successful. We've financed 15 homes with the original pool of money that OER provided to us. So we're asking for $750,000 to capitalize this fund. Okay, let me pause for comments or questions on the program budget that you will be voting on before I turn it over to Kara.
I think the one general area I would comment, I think the format of this presentation is outstanding. It's very clear. It captures the focus on the important items overall, but gives us opportunity to comment on the individual details. One area I'm going to ask the board to consider is whether we could capitalize a small investment in what I hope will be someday a major initiative for the corporation, which is to make sure that every family that we assist has broadband access. I think as we talk about tomorrow, investing for tomorrow, as we talk about taking on these new initiatives, I don't want to commit ourselves to a large program, but I think I'd like to establish a pool of money that allows the staff to plan and move forward on this agenda. So I think it's one of the ways that we reduce inequities is in making sure that poor people have the access to broadband.
And Nick, would you envision that? And I don't want to put ourselves in a corner here, but would you envision that fund to provide money to build out the infrastructure, and so it would be more of a short-term type fund,
or would you envision it being
operating kind of subsidy?
I want to turn that question over to, not literally turn it over, but turn it over to the management to kind of think through. I don't think we ought to be in the business of designing in detail these individual programs,
sure.
But I think the basic infrastructure is very important as a precondition. But I hope we'll be able to go beyond that also. But again, it's really just putting a stake in the ground, saying this is something we're going to focus on. This will be a priority for us in the forthcoming year.
Okay.
Yep. And Carol, this is Maria. I agree. This is a great presentation. It's so clear and really comprehensive. I just had one question. Actually, it's back on the previous section. Can you just talk a little bit about the $5 million for workforce housing and kind of how that's going and what you foresee for this coming year?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Eric, you're on, correct?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. So I know that the team has invested resources in two developments. One, a development on 195 Postle, and another that is, I believe, in South Providence. So both of those projects are moving forward and have been successful. Eric, can you talk a little bit about your plans for this next tranche of money and how you foresee rolling this out?
Yes. So the first round, as as Carol just mentioned, we had the two transactions, but we had a lot of appetite from development community. We have a number of tax credit proposals that we anticipate this current round that are mixed use. That's really in a sweet spot for workforce housing. We've had a number of conversations with developers that are contemplating projects. So based on those conversations, we knew that, again, there was an appetite for it, that we wanted to create a product to serve that. So we're tweaking the program. We hope to have an RFP out next month so we can address this. So we anticipate a lot of need out there.
Okay, thanks. And just one other quick question. How are you taking a look at sort of rental rates in light of COVID, and are you seeing a change in that workforce housing piece, or what are your thoughts there?
So we've been having a number of conversations with appraisers, and right now it hasn't really impacted adversely the levels. However, we anticipate in the future. So we're really looking at the absorption rates, and it's something that we have to constantly monitor. Right now, we haven't seen drastic rental rates change.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks. I agree. It's very dynamic, and it's a little hard to assess. So I think it's great that you're going to continually look at it. Thank you.
So, Nick, this is Carol. Did you have a recommended funding amount, or would you be looking to us as leaders in the agency to propose something for this program budget for the next? We're short year now. We only have 7 months left in this fiscal year.
My preference is to ask you to come up with what you think is a reasonable number.
Happy to
really
do that.
I'm saying this is the direction we're going in, as opposed to saying this is a destination.
Happy to do that. Okay. We will then roll something in and have it ready for the board meeting.
Thank you.
This is Kevin. I've got a question, Carol, about the home ownership program. It was mentioned that in the narrative of $16 million and down payment assistance. I'm assuming that's built in and paid for from bond proceeds. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
That's correct.
Okay. Yep. And then the there's $1 million in agency resources to provide mortgage financing for deed-restricted homes. I guess I don't see that million here in the program budget spreadsheet. And I also could you explain that program briefly?
Yeah. So over the years, we have created hundreds of deed-restricted properties, homeownership opportunities, either through the Federal Home Program or, through Building Homes Rhode Island and other programs created by the state grant programs that are deed-restricted for long periods of time. What we ran into was difficulty in taking these deed-restricted properties through FHA, which is one of our primary programs. So on resale, folks were having incredible difficulty identifying sources of mortgage financing. So in order to not lose deed-restricted inventory and have people not be able to get out from under those deed restrictions, we created, I believe last year, Kevin, we created a $2 million pool that we've downsized to $1 million this year because there wasn't a huge amount of demand. I think that credit unions and other financial institutions are getting a little bit more comfortable with deed-restricted properties, so the demand that we thought we would have for $2 million really wasn't there. So I think it's important that we keep a placeholder to ensure that these units can get financed long-term. But I'm not seeing it at the level that I saw it at last year.
Okay, so should there be $1 million, therefore, in this?
I think $1 million is a comfortable place for us to be in the event that there is demand. So this would probably allow us to do at a maximum 10 homeownership units, and I think that's reasonable as a placeholder.
Okay, just to, not to beat this too much, but there's a currently zero I'm seeing right now in the this program budget for that item.
Right, because we're financing it elsewhere, Kevin. That's why.
Oh, so it's not out of, okay.
It's not out of operating dollars, right? It was
Got
previously
it.
Out of operating dollars. I believe we've moved it to the trust.
Got it. Okay. Thank you. I think we can keep moving.
Good. Okay. So I'm going to turn it over to Kara, and she's going to give you a presentation on the balance of what's in that packet. Kara?
Great. Thank you, Carol. Good morning. We will start with a chart on page 6. This chart is a summary of the main categories that make up our budget, and I'll go through each line to discuss changes from prior year. The first line is net interest income, which is the largest component of revenue. This is the interest that we receive on our single-family and multifamily loans, less the interest we pay on our bonds and our lines of credit, which we may use to finance those loans. The fiscal year 21 budget is estimated at $29.3 million, and that reflects a slight increase from prior year, primarily as a result of bonds being refinanced at lower interest rates. We are seeing a slight decrease in interest income due to delinquency and forbearance for our single-family loans. So the reduction in the bond interest expense has allowed us to maintain that level of net interest income and improve slightly on that for fiscal 21. This line item is approximately 60% from our multifamily development loans and 40% from our single-family homeownership loans. The next category is fee income, and these are fees that we earn for servicing our loans, for managing programs, federal and state programs, and underwriting and loan origination fees. The fiscal year 21 budget of $19.5 million does reflect a 5% reduction. That reduction is primarily due to the single-family loan estimates that we do think we will be going down in terms of our production in the single-family side. It's also related to a reduction in our servicing fees as we're not able to charge late fees and other types of typical servicing fees due to the federal moratorium. The gain on sale of loans had a very large increase, you'll see, in the actual amount for fiscal year 20 of 8.9. That's in a different column, the 8.9 million. At the time of the shutdown, we were in the process of issuing bonds, and the resulting economic disruption kind of made that impossible. So we did turn to the TBA market, and we sold those loans that we were holding, getting ready to put into the bond issue. And that resulted in very high gains, unexpected, higher than we had budgeted. The fiscal year 21 budget, which is just under $3.5 million, reflects a more balanced approach back to between bonds and TBA sales. So we're estimating approximately 60% bonds and 40% TBA sales. Moving on to the expense line items, we're budgeting $3 million for loan losses. We're expecting a similar level of need to cover our potential delinquencies. Over the last several years, we've been able to shift our portfolio to more federally insured loans, FHA loans, which have reduced our losses, the losses directly to Rhode Island Housing. We do an extensive review with our auditors at our fiscal year end for our allowance, and we were found to be adequate. We did increase it slightly in June 30, 2020, and so we believe the $3 million will be adequate for this upcoming year.
Kara, this is Kevin. Yes. I'd just like to jump in there.
Of course.
I'm looking at your the chart that you provided on page 8, this handout. It showed on the left side, it shows loan losses and expenses. I think we were peaking in this regard back in 2013 and 14 at about $11 million in loan losses in tougher economic times. And the trough, I guess, has been lately down around that $3 million level. I know you've done a lot of analysis on it, but I still have a lot of – I don't want to be overly optimistic, I suppose, maybe, about things. I would imagine that we're going to see more layoffs and, at best, maybe an economic stagnation this coming year. So do you feel that it is appropriate, really, to keep the I'm thinking maybe we should see an increase in a loan loss reserve, not keeping it at kind of the best of times level, if you could comment on that a little bit more.
Sure. So one of the things that is actually helping us, all the new loans that we are adding are all 100% federally insured. So anything that's been added to our portfolio in the last few years are all 100% insured. The loans that the older loans that maybe had MI insurance or are now uninsured, many of those have actually been able to refinance because they've gained equity in their properties. So our portfolio has changed so that insurance is really covering us. We may still have the same number of loans, but now the risk is less. And so that was one of the discussions that we had with our auditors and also with the rating agencies regarding how much we keep for a reserve. From an accounting standpoint, it is a little difficult to project more than a year out. They don't like you to say, well, you know, it's a little unknown. We need a cushion. It really should be based on your current portfolio and how you think that will perform in the next year. I also think that because there is, you know, we're not able to foreclose right now. There are moratoriums in place. And even when we are, I think we will take our time and try to work with borrowers that we won't experience, you know, large losses in fiscal 21. And we may in fiscal 22 take a different look at that, really see where the economy is and if it's appropriate to take action on any of those borrowers. So I think it's a combination of those things.
Okay. And so what are our total loan loss reserves right now?
We're at $45 million in loan loss reserves.
Okay. In the peak loss, was that true about $11 million?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, we had a couple of years of 10, 11 million, and then you see on that chart on page 8 how it went down over time.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. The next line in expenses is the programmatic expenses, and Carol has gone over that. The $4.1 million is what actually comes out of the operating budget. Some of those other program expenses are funded through our trust and through federal programs or issuing bonds. And then the operating expense budget at $37.2 million does reflect a small increase compared to prior year. We did have reductions in many line items, such as seminars and training and travel, but those were offset by increases in the health insurance rates and also increases in technology, you know, specifically required to to make sure that we were, for privacy, for remote working and that type of thing. We've reflected that transfer to the state that Carol has mentioned, which right now is at 1.1, but we'll see once the budget is enacted. And I'll stop there to see if there are any other questions.
Thank you so much, Kara. Really appreciate it. Sure. Any questions, Nick, Liz, Maria?
Actually, it's Maria. Just a quick question. So the transfer to the state, the 1.5, that actually did happen, right? And we're projecting it around 1.1 for 21?
That's correct. Right. Yeah, the 1.1 was in the original budget that the governor had presented early in the year. And so, you know, that is still up for a decision to be made on that transfer.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. The next couple of pages are slides. Slide number 7 is a graph that just shows historical increases or decreases in each revenue category over the last several years. And you can see it's been fairly stable or increasing over time. Graph number 8 is the same format for our expenses. As Kevin pointed out, you can see the loan losses at the peak in 2014 and then gradually reducing. Also, our programmatic expenses and how we've been able to contribute back to the community and our overall operating expenses. Page 9 is a chart that tracks what we've done in single family home ownership loans, and that is split out by how much is bonded in the blue section of the columns versus loans sold in the TBA market in the green section. The orange line represents loans on our balance sheet and how our balance sheet is either growing or contracting based on the single family production. And you can see how that has changed over time as we navigate the market and choose the best execution for our loans. And the final page, page 10, has the detailed line items for our operating expenses. These I won't go into, you know, line by line. We have spoken about these, but in general, I would comment that our actual expenses in 2020 did come in below budget. Once the state of emergency was declared, we took immediate action to reduce non-essential spending and to furlough staff. In the first section, you'll see a 3.7% increase in the overall personnel budget for fiscal year 21 compared to 20. And as Carol mentioned, this relates to health insurance rates that were increased. We also have increased costs for unemployment because we did furlough staff and had some reduction in staff. And our retirement expense also looks like it's increased. It really was artificially low in the prior year, because we had used accrued forfeited funds. So that is the, you know, that's the majority of the increase there. The middle section are all the operating line items. We see a small 2% increase over fiscal year 20 budget. As discussed, you know, there are decreases in many of those line items, which are offset primarily by the increases in technology and software. So I can stop there if there are any specific questions.
Hearing no other questions or comments, I'd like to thank you, Kara, and Carol, and the rest of the staff. I think this has been a fantastic presentation and allows us to really get a great broad picture, but also dive into some of the details to fully understand your assumptions going forward. So again, I very much appreciate it, and I think it's been a productive use of our time. So again, unless there's any other comment on this, I'd like to move to our next discussion item, which is the impact of the COVID pandemic on multifamily servicing. And Michael DiCiaro, the Assistant Director of Asset Management, will present this. Please go ahead, Mike.
Thank you, Kevin, and good morning, everyone. This is Michael DiCiaro, and I just wanted to provide you with a brief overview of some of the impacts the pandemic has had on our asset management team, and also highlight some of the innovative ways that we've been able to stay connected with our ownership and management partners, as well as residents of our rental developments. I believe you all have a copy of a memo that I prepared for this meeting. So what I'll do is just go through that memo and highlight a few of the key points. Before I do that, though, I really have to give credit to our staff for their exemplary performance this year, especially amidst we had some very inconsistent guidance from our federal partners and had us adjusting and scrambling, resetting quite often during the pandemic. But through all these challenges, they've continued to support our owners and managers and residents, and they've really done an exemplary job. So I just wanted to recognize my staff for the work that they've done this year. Speaking of staffing, just a quick overview. There's 18 staff in our department. We are responsible for all of the federal compliance, tax credit, Section 8, home, ancillary financing, all the compliance-related aspects of those programs our teams are responsible for, as well as managing the financial performance of our financed portfolio, whether it's collecting audits, reviewing budgets, interim financial statements. We also approve distribution of surplus cash, so we're very involved in all of our existing developments. We had 10 staff that were furloughed between April and June, and all staff is back working now. As Carol mentioned earlier, you know, most of our staff is working remote, maybe once or twice a week. Folks are going into the office if they need to, but for the most part, we're working remotely. I want to talk initially about the PPCA. So these are the Section 8 properties in our portfolio, not necessarily financed, but we're responsible for administering the Section 8 contracts for HUD. MORs, which are the management and occupancy reviews, these are the audits that we conduct on those properties. So HUD issued a moratorium and suspended MORs for 3 months at the beginning of the pandemic. Timing was actually perfect for us. We had just gone through a lean process in this department, looking for ways to innovate and improve our efficiencies. And we actually had just rolled out a new online method of doing file reviews remotely instead of having to go to the sites. So as soon as the moratorium was introduced, we actually went to the Boston HUD office and provided them with an overview of what we'd like to do during the moratorium. They were very impressed. They sent it to Washington. They sent it to other states and told folks to model, to begin modeling a monitoring system similar to Rhode Island. So we're really proud of that. We were able to, you know, again, roll that out right away. As soon as the moratorium was lifted, we put that into place, and we really caught up on the MORs that we had missed for those 3 months. Let's see if I can get some numbers in there. 81. We did 81 management occupancy reviews between June and October, compared to 40 completed at the same period in 2019. So typically, prior to the pandemic, we were sending, you know, two, sometimes three staff to a property to conduct an MOR. With this new remote system, we're able to actually do MORs individually. So each asset manager has a portfolio. They could conduct their reviews electronically and didn't need the assistance of other staff. Just an example of some of the flexibility. We had a manager and still have a manager who refuses to upload files through our system for whatever reason, and HUD does not require them to do that. But we still wanted to conduct the reviews, so we actually had staff go to the site and conduct file reviews in their cars. HUD prohibits files leaving the site, so we thought it was pretty innovative to say, okay, we'll keep the files on site, but we'll do our work in the parking lot in the cars, and you know, it kept our staff safe. It satisfied the HUD requirements, and management was satisfied with our efforts there. It's really important that we got back and did these MORs. We do receive an admin fee for each MOR, and it's pretty significant. So we were pleased to be able to, you know, get back up and catch up on the missed MORs. In that department, we also administered funding for HUD's CSP, which is the COVID supplemental payments. So similar to the conversation we had earlier regarding using funds to help support developments for COVID-related expenses, HUD rolled out a program with CARES Act money allowing Section 8 developments to get reimbursed for expenses that they have expended for COVID-related items. It was kind of a cumbersome program, and we had to work through, again, some challenging guidance from HUD. But we worked together, we pulled together, and we were able to process those requests. We did earn a top-tier rating from HUD because we met all the guidelines of all the deadlines that they had provided. The fee was not expensive, probably just barely covered our expenses, but nonetheless, we were rated as top-tier from HUD, which is great. On the tax credit compliance side, we are still operating today under an IRS waiver that does not require tax credit compliance reviews. So they've said from April 1st through the end of the year that HFAs across the country do not have to do tax credit reviews. We were concerned because, you know, we do like to visit our properties every year, and we want to make sure that there are, that the managers are understanding federal guidance, they're managing their properties properly. So we, instead of just eliminating reviews completely, we implemented a modified tax credit review process, reducing the sampling size. Because again, it's critical that we went out and looked at these properties. So we've done 76 of those abbreviated reviews between April and the end of October. On the financial management side, again, we were very well positioned for this work from home transition. We had kind of worked over the last couple of years to move all of our manual processes, to automate all of our manual processes. So, you know, 2 years ago, we were receiving financial statements in the mail from auditors. You know, last year, we've required them all to send us electronic versions, so we had that in place already. So it was, the transition to working remotely was not a steep curve there. Just a couple of numbers. Between March and September, we reviewed 149 financial audit for our developments. And this review includes, you know, a review of the audit, balance sheet, income statements, but a detailed review of income and expenses. Staff also compiles, and they did compile for the 2019 audits, a summary of operating expenses throughout our development. And this is really helpful to us in asset management, but also to our development partners. We use it internally, obviously, as a guide when reviewing proposals for new finance transactions, and we distributed it to our nonprofit partners over the last couple of weeks. We also distributed it at the QAP webinar that we conducted a few weeks ago for developers that are considering submitting deals on a 9% tax credit round. It just helps them to understand other developments in the state and understand where their expense level should be. We have a very good idea of what it costs to operate a property in Rhode Island, and you know, we certainly want to be open and transparent with our partners, and this is a great way to help share the information that we collect. We've also this year approved and disbursed about $22 million in surplus cash and collected about $3 million towards Rhode Island Housing deferred loan payments as well as preservation fees. And we also are responsible for disbursing NOP funds. So we disbursed about $350,000 in NOP funds this year. And these funds really support the developments that house some of our most vulnerable residents. These are not the large tax credit or Section 8 developments. These are the small mom and pop developments that really rely on this NOP subsidy to keep their doors open. And all of this was done remotely. So then we also look at the financial impact that the pandemic has had on our portfolio and on our individual sites. Thankfully, to date, we still have had no delinquencies in the multifamily portfolio. All properties have paid their debt service timely within 30 days of due date. So we've reported no delinquency through the entire pandemic, which is great. We've also received no formal request for forbearance of debt service as a result of the impacts of COVID. We have received 21 requests for relief, miscellaneous requests. We had several that, you know, asked to allow surplus cash to stay in their operating account to help support potential future losses. We've waived some reserve requirements, monthly reserve payment requirements, when the reserves were adequately funded and the site needed a little operating, additional operating support. But again, no formal forbearance of debt service. We've also dug deep into some of the most recent quarterly financial reporting. And for the most part through the pandemic, we've been, you know, lucky that it appears that our developments are doing well. Certainly the $600 at the beginning of the pandemic was helpful, and a lot of residents that may have been delinquent on their rental payments actually used that additional income to catch up. So we saw an initial reduction in rent receivables. That trend is going in the other direction right now. As of the end of September, it looks like the total tenant receivables in our portfolio is about 40% higher than it was last year. But the number of households that are delinquent, it's only up about 5% from last year. So what that tells us is, you know, about the same amount of a few more households are showing signs of default or delinquency, but it's a larger number. And I think it's because, number one, the moratoriums have prevented evictions. And also, I think our owners and managers are being a little more flexible and working with our residents, entering into repayment agreements. Again, occupancy remains strong. Right now, it looks to be about 98%. And the total past due rents as of September 30th is almost $1.5 million. I also want to talk to you a little bit about external communication. So again, immediately when the pandemic hit and we were all in the situation working from home and not knowing where to communicate, you know, when the communication was coming from the state or federal government, a lot of information was hitting us very quickly. So we immediately stood up a dedicated page on our website to provide up-to-date information and useful links to our partners. In the memo, I provided a couple of screenshots of both the web page and a sample of one of the e-blasts that we did. We've done several email communications to our partners just to keep them informed, whether it's guidance from HUD or the state, or, you know, we went out with a few e-blasts regarding some community resources available for residents. We asked that managers post some resources in the common areas to let folks know that there are resources available for helping, assisting with hardships. And again, I give staff all the credit. We've got extraordinary staff with strong technical skills. They were able to create, distribute, and analyze surveys. We still use a survey that sites report to us their COVID-related illnesses. We've gotten surveys for past due rents, for pending evictions, and we actually created a survey that went directly to residents of a particular management company that we had some concerns with, so we're able to target those folks and go out with a customer service survey. Let's see. Most recently, and this is exciting, we announced a new communications platform for residents of our rental developments. So when we merged our tax credit compliance group with the PBCA group about 2 years ago, we immediately recognized that there was a need for us to track the customer complaints that we receive, both for our records so we can monitor our management agents, but also, you know, we've got to provide reports to HUD on a monthly basis about the number of calls we receive. So again, our staff in asset management created an online tool using Smartsheet to manage that process and to track all of our resident complaints. Between April 1st and October 30th, we responded to and resolved 301 separate incidents or concerns that were raised by residents. So what we're rolling out now, and we actually just did it last week, a couple of things. We've got a new online tool. We like to call it a virtual assistant. It's called Chatbot. And this is similar to, I don't know if anyone's ever been on online trying to look at their cell phone bill or something, and a little, you know, virtual assistant pops up on the side and asks you questions, and you can type that in. So this is the same thing. We've preloaded it with answers to many frequently asked questions. We can direct folks to legal services or other resources they might need. And ultimately, if we can't solve their problem through that chatbot, we provide them with a list of who their property manager is, their contact number, the property manager, as well as the asset manager at Rhode Island Housing that's responsible for their particular property. So we just rolled that out last week. We've also rolled out a new dedicated email and voicemail line for customer complaints. Previously, each asset manager would have calls from their site, and as you can imagine, many residents would call, and they call the wrong person, and there's a lot of transfers back and forth. So we've established a dedicated line for those calls, and just to help improve our efficiency. Let's see. So what's not in the memo? A couple brief things. We've also stood up an online tool that's going to help us communicate and share information with our New England HFA colleagues. Asset management staff from the six New England states, we meet annually, and it's a great opportunity for us to learn from and share with our local partners, but it's only once a year. So this tool, again, developed from asset management staff, by asset management staff, is being hosted by us, and it allows us to communicate directly with the targeted staff from each of those states. So every HFA has, you know, a PVCA staff, or tax credit staff, or financial audit staff. So this tool allows us to communicate across borders and keep everyone up to date, and it keeps a record of our conversations. So instead of, you know, spending time going to try to figure out, you know, who in Maine is the PVCA person, it's already preloaded, and someone from out of state can send a question or post some information, and it goes to all the states immediately. We're hosting a virtual tax credit compliance training this Friday for members of the Ballant Institute of Real Estate Management. And we sponsored a two-day compliance training last month with Costello Compliance, who was our tax credit compliance consultant. They helped us draft our award-winning tax credit compliance manual last year. So that was very well attended. We've got over 100 people registered for this Friday's training. I think we have about 170 people for the webinar that Costello put on with us. Looking forward, we've caught up on our MOR, so that will, you know, reduce the amount of MORs we're doing going forward. So we will focus more on the tax credit compliance side. The IRS moratorium on compliance audits expires in January, although we do expect an extension, but there's certainly a backlog of tax credit reviews, full tax credit reviews, for us to do later on in 2021. We also expect to resume REAC inspections next year, and five of our staff are certified in REAC inspections. So again, we're always looking to improve our efficiency. We're continuing to collect a tremendous amount of data, and we're certainly finding that it's sometimes challenging to manage all that data. So looking very forward to reviewing proposals that were recently received from an RFP for some additional added automation to our asset management systems. We'll also hopefully link development data from loan origination and tax credit allocation through construction and asset management. So again, I can't say it enough. I'm very proud of our team. They've worked extremely hard. But we also understand that we'll continue to be challenged. The work we do is complex, and it continues to grow in both volume and complexity. But I think we're well positioned to handle whatever comes our way. And we'll continue to stay engaged with our developments, making sure they're providing a high level of service to their residents. And finally, I need to just recognize quickly our property managers throughout the state. Their job is not easy, and you know, it was polarized this year, the work that they do with their residents. It's difficult to maintain compliance with these complex regulations, but also to be supportive and compassionate with their residents. During the lockdowns and quarantines, the communications that management staff had with their residents is sometimes the only interaction that many residents are having. So for the most part, we certainly have our exceptions, but for the most part, they've really stepped up and provided a level of service that's not always recognized, but is so important to our residents in our low-income developments, especially the elderly and other vulnerable populations. So I'm happy to answer any questions anybody may have.
Mike, thank you very much. I mean, that's super income information rich, I meant to say, presentation and memo, and really gives us a great view into your operations. And I think probably more importantly is just very, very impressive way to shift your whole department, shifting to this kind of new reality under the pandemic, and finding new ways to be, well, it looks like even more efficient than before. So really applaud the efforts there. And so exciting to hear about so many of these initiatives that you're working on. I mean, just one in particular, I think it's great to have this site so that in New England, you can be speaking with your peers and have a record of all that, you know, those conversations. So thank you again. I'll start off with one question, and I'll open it up to,
sure,
to others. So in terms of multifamily loan collections, great to see no defaults or on record now by mm-hmm. any of our borrowers. And then I guess the borrowers themselves are feeling a bit of that pain in terms of rent delinquencies. But it hasn't been that great. And as you say, it seems to be concentrated in a few number of renters, those that probably are just having high balances because they're staying in the units and not being evicted as perhaps they normally would be. And hopefully there'll be some rental assistance to help with those residents. Then we get down, I guess, to the residents themselves. I wonder, and I know that we haven't been directly involved in this, but what if you could speak to the rental assistance programs, the state-funded ones, the Housing Help Rhode mm-hmm. Island, I think, with $6.5 million of funding, and the Safe Harbor Housing Program of $7 million of funding. How have those gone, say, from a resident perspective? Are they able to apply and get assistance, or are they being stymied, or what's happening there?
So as I understand it, it's been successful. I don't know if Christine or someone else can speak to the utilization of the funds, but I know that many of our managers and owners have referred folks to these programs, and I've heard success stories. I don't have the details on it, but anecdotally, I've heard positive stories, especially from the Rhode Island-funded program, the Housing Help. Yeah, Hold the Homes.
Kevin,
yeah,
this is
exactly.
Chris. I can speak a little bit to it. So Housing Help and Safe Harbor are now just now kind of getting up to speed and being able to process the requests that had been backlogged for a while. So I think that the folks who came in from those developments will start to see more activity, more payouts happening there. There's a proposal before the state to work to contact landlords in general, larger landlords. So that would include the affordable housing development landlords, to kind of work with them to get all of their tenants who are behind on their rent into the system. So that proposal is pending with the state, and I should have an answer as to whether or not they'll allow it by the end of the week. If they do, it is my hope that we'll be able to help out the folks who live there and those properties significantly before the end of the year, which is when the money has to be spent by.
I think it would be helpful to keep track of that a bit more. I'd like to know some more details as you kind of get that information. I did just look online a little bit. There's not much out there in the press, but I did come across one article that, again, this is very anecdotal, but just mentioned, residents, trying to apply, but, multiple calls, not going anywhere, the Housing Help Rhode Island saying it was backlogged and not taking any more apps. So is it functioning now or not? If somebody wants rental assistance, can they get it?
Yes. So I've been asked to help out Commerce to make those programs run. So I've spent the last 2 weeks working with those programs, those partners in the state to streamline what's required on the part of tenants to submit, making it easier for them to achieve a completed application and get process. So last week they were able to double the number of applications that they approved and the number that they paid out. So I think you'll see that as they get used to it, right? This new process, that increase even more. And like I said, we've got a couple of other programs that I anticipate being able to reach a large number of tenants who are behind on their rent, and to kind of help make landlords whole. I would caution you on taking the cues from the press. We are trying very hard to not have her announce anything, the governor announce anything from the podium so that the systems don't get backlogged again. We're working directly with on-the-ground providers of all kinds to make sure that they know how to help tenants get into the program. But every time the governor announces something from the podium, the system gets overrun, and then it breaks, and then we're backlogged. And you only have until December 30th. To take in applications, process them, and pay them out. So we're trying very hard not to overload a system that just can't take it. You know, you can get 5,000 applications over 3 weeks. If you get them in one day, it's a different scenario.
Okay, great. Thank you. Any other comments or questions?
I just have one comment and one question. Mike, let me echo what Kevin said. I think it's remarkable what you've been able to accomplish in terms of the changes and the reengineering, not just in response to COVID, but just in response to doing a better job. So that's great to hear all that and what you're doing, and thanks for keeping us informed along the way. My question is, I'm pleased to hear you're interacting with the other HFAs, at least in New England, because HFAs are such strange animals. But I wonder whether you do any benchmarking with private sector lenders in terms of their oversight of some of their properties?
We do get some data from Mortgage Bankers Association, and even some of our trade groups publish data. The problem with the financial information, it's always so stale data. You know, by the time we get it, it's usually a couple of years late. So I would say no, we're not getting real-time information from market rate developments. It's mostly the stuff that we look at is other affordable developments throughout the country.
Okay.
Hi, it's Maria. My question was the exact same as Kevin, so I have no questions, but just wanted to say great update, really thorough, and thanks for all the hard work you and your team are doing.
Thank you, Maria.
Okay, great. Here are no other comments or questions. Thank you again, Mike. And now we'll allow Eric to present the multifamily development during COVID.
Great. Thank you, Kevin. Similar to Mike, and I'll try to refrain from spending the next 5 minutes just giving kudos to my team, but they deserve an extreme amount of acknowledgement for the work that they've done during this challenging time, and I'm extremely proud of them. I also uploaded a memo to give a quick update about the impact of COVID-19 on the development divisions on multifamily operations. You had that, so I'll just highlight a couple of things. But as I was preparing my comments, I was reminded of author James Allen's famous quote: "Adversity does not build character; it reveals it." And our, you know, during this challenging time, our character, you know, it really revealed who we are, quite frankly, not only as a group, but as an organization. And I can say without fear of contradiction that as a group and as an organization, we demonstrated extraordinary nimbleness, commitment, and being resourceful. And that's evident by, you know, just the sort of the closings. And I'll just highlight a couple of things. The multifamily, we, by the end of the year, we'll have 14 transactions closed, resulting in the creation or the preservation of over 1,100 units. That's on par or exceeds previous years. You have what we've done over from 2017 to this year. And given this crisis, that's amazing, quite frankly. And, you know, so those are the sure numbers. What doesn't show up on the scorecard is how do you get those numbers? And it required us really being resourceful, and folks are going beyond the call of duty. Because of these transactions, we did a great work in terms of the infrastructure, and I'll speak a little more about this later in terms of IT and infrastructure and things like that, electronic. But a lot of these transactions still require wet signatures. And quite frankly, we've been more efficient during this period of time, but tracking down kind of signatures has been difficult. And staff have gone beyond the call of duty in terms of getting other agency signatures, going to their homes after hours to get those signatures, to get transactions closed. That's just, I have a list of things like that I can talk to you about where staff have gone beyond the call of duty to get the job done. So of the 14 transactions that we've closed, 13 were pre-COVID, 11 was actually during the pandemic. So the lion's share of the work was committed during the pandemic. It's just been really phenomenal in the work there. Also, that's just the transactions. Our design and construction team is currently managing 65 projects in various stages of our construction. Not only have we been able to create and preserve housing units throughout the state, but we've been able to keep people working during this crisis. And, you know, Carol mentioned in her opening about our contributions to the economy. I think the number was $700 million or something like that. This was, you know, a lot of families are hurting and able to keep folks working. We did not shut down any construction jobs. We were able to keep jobs going. We were able to protect staff. We were able to protect the workers on the jobs, as well as residents and units where work was done in place. So all these things were phenomenal, and we had to kind of create policies and procedures on the fly. And we did those things, and we adhered to those policies and kept jobs going. So as proud I am of our development team, I'm equally as proud as my colleagues throughout the organization, because if not for their hard work and commitment to us, none of the stuff I just mentioned would have been possible. Just want to give Lisa and her team a shout out. She procured PPE equipment for staff and workers, CJ and the IT team. Carol mentioned this earlier, but without their work in the infrastructure, the IT infrastructure, and procuring laptops that allowed staff to work remotely and the technology for us to communicate. We, you know, participate on Teams calls, Zoom calls. All this work goes unnoticed, but it's critical for the success and allowing us to keep operations going smoothly. Our finance team has been outstanding. In addition to Kara and sort of managing operations and the budget, but just we've become more efficient in processing checks during this pandemic. I mean, we're turning around checks in 2 to 3 days, which is phenomenal. It was taking 7 to 10 days prior to that. So, and our legal team has been phenomenal in working with us in closing transactions. So it's been really good. We still have a lot of work to do, but I can say without fear of contradiction, we haven't dropped a lot. A lot of things haven't fallen through the cracks. So we continue to do deals in the pipeline. We're going to talk about this a little bit later. We're very confident in having a very robust pipeline for next year. A lot of the work we've been doing is really kind of the business development side of it, and talking to folks and programs. And Maria Berry, you asked earlier about sort of the workforce housing. We've been having a number of conversations about that, and we've feel very confident in that we'll be able to deploy those funds based on the conversations that we've had. I'll pause there because I think that kind of summarizes where we are in terms of the closings and what we've done in terms of managing the construction process. I'm sure there are a number of questions, so I'll pause and allow you guys to ask questions, and we'll go from there.
Great. Thank you so much, Eric. Appreciate that presentation, and it's fantastic to hear of it seems, I would say, even an increase in workload and productivity during this period. So that's wonderful. I'd like to open it up to comments or questions from anyone.
Eric, that's a great presentation. It reflects a lot of great work, and congratulations to you and your team. I guess I hesitate to bring this up. I don't want to – everything's been so great and wonderful. What do you worry most about?
I worry about, to be honest with you, I worry about the team. You have an extremely committed team here to the mission of this organization. And I'm concerned about burnout. We're asking folks to do more with less. And so I'm really concerned about that. And sort of everyone jumps in hands, you know, all hands on deck. Like I said, just simple things to get closing. Carol mentioned in our opening that, you know, we closed the first transaction earlier this week on Monday, I believe it's Tuesday, for the CARES Act money, Rockville Mill. Just the amount of running around to get documents signed was a difficult task, and folks went beyond the call of duty to do that.
This is Carol. I want to reflect on that as well, because we are folks are working very hard. Folks are getting things done. There's an incredible pressure on the agency to help, you know, other state agencies with the burden that they're trying to carry. So, for example, we have deployed Christine to Commerce. She mentioned that she will be working directly with Commerce through the end of December. So that means most of her time is being spent trying to assist the state to stand up their programs and make them successful, which is important to all of us in Rhode Island. So there is incredible pressure. Folks can't go on vacation. Folks, there's nowhere to go, because if you go, when you come back, you have to quarantine for 14 days. So it's, and then people are dealing with home educating children and, you know, loved ones that may be in the hospital or in nursing homes. So the everyday pressures of work is just magnified by all of this other distraction going on. And I'm sure all of you feel it. All of the board members, I'm sure, feel it. It's not just employees of Rhode Island Housing.
That's well said. Well said.
Kevin, I wanted to let you know that Liz Tanner had to jump off to take another call, and I wanted to confirm for you that the deed restricted program is indeed being funded through the trust this year.
Okay, great. Thank you. And I realize we're running on a little long here. I just have one question for you, Eric. We have a lot of jobs under construction, which is great to see. And a number of these are preservation related. So they are, I think there's 26 noted here. So
correct.
They are occupied renovations. Without going into the details, have any of these developments run into, you know, problems due to COVID, and either they had to, you know, switch the way they were going to, you know, go about the phasing of the work, or have any, you know, COVID illnesses pop up or anything like that?
So in terms of, we had three projects that were delayed as a result of COVID, and they're highlighted on your sheet in yellow there, 4042 Park, Festival Field, and Olneyville Redux. And my understanding was that the delays was really regarding sort of the relocation of those families in those units, and finding suitable options for them. I have Tony Yvonne here as well, who's a part, can give you real time. Is there anything else in terms of?
Yeah, the delays, there were some little slight hiccups along the way, but most of them we were able to adjust to because developments have outside work and things like that. So it gave us a little bit of time to get the COVID work plans in place and COVID affidavits in place so they could work in a safe environment. So, what we were a little lucky on the preservation deals because many of them have pretty extensive work within the units and they have other conditions like asbestos or lead. So we had already had planned to move those tenants out. So those COVID plans were sort of plug and play and they were easy to do. The ones that struggled a little bit were ones that closed and planned on. They had sort of very minuscule construction within the units, but they were planning on keeping the tenants in those units and not relocating them anywhere. Those are the ones that got stuck a little bit. But we ended up working around those and coming up with, you know, moving some resources around so we can get a temporary relocation plan in place and do the work safely.
Great. Thank you, Tony. That makes a lot of sense.
Hi, it's Maria. I just wanted to say thank you to Eric and team. Amazing work. I can relate to how challenging this time is to get all these projects underway and completed and monitor and everything you're all doing. So thank you. And Kevin, I actually need to hop for another meeting as well. So do you have enough people if I jump off?
Well, I think we're done. So thank you for your participation, and certainly, yeah, we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Okay, terrific. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Stay well.
Yep.
Bye.
I guess we could go. I think could maybe Eric quickly jump to the pipeline if there's anything you feel material to bring up today, John?
No. Actually, we really talked about is really at this point the pipeline is really the construction projects. As I mentioned, we're just trying to really build our pipeline for next year. We're working on that. It's nothing really to kind of report other than the projects under construction, and we just dealt with that.
Okay. Maybe for next meeting, if you could highlight Lippitt Mill, Barbara yep. Jordan, to the workforce housing developments that
okay.
we've approved for funding, and then also the ARP, the Acquisition Revitalization Program projects.
Okay. Yep. Got it.
Update on those. Thank
okay.
you. And Nick, let's see. I guess there's no further business, so I'd like to request a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
And I guess I'll have to second it. Nicole, do we even do a roll call since we no longer have a quorum or?
No, we don't. We should just do it just out of an abundance of caution. So why don't we just quickly go through it and then we should be all set. This is Nicole Clement. When I call your name, if you are in favor of adjourning this meeting, please respond by saying aye or opposed by saying nay. Commissioner Orth?
Aye.
Commissioner Resines?
Aye.
The vote is unanimous.
Great. Thank you, Nicole. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks, everybody.
Yep.
Thank you, Kevin.
Sure. Thanks, Nick.